This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 89, Dongshan's No Grass. The pointer. Move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. Don't move and sprouts grow right where you are. You must cast off both sides and let the middle go too. Then buy some sandals and travel some more so that you can really attain realization. The main case. Master Dongshan said to the assembly, it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you must go, some to the east, some to the west. Go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. He also said, but where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? Master Shishuang, hearing about this, said, going out the gate, immediately there's grass. Master Dayang said, I'd say, even not going out the gate, still, the grass is boundless. In the verse, grass boundless, inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look, look, how many kinds. For the while, going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. So this is nice. You know, I have a dream that one day I'd like to have a kind of pavilion out here with some sort of a platform so that we could practice outside and be close to these elements. So we're concluding a poetry festival, a Buddhist poetry festival, which many of you are attending. Margaret Gibson, who's still here, and Chase Twitchell, our own students, and Jane Hirschfield, David Hinton, were the poets in residence who were honoring us with their work and their persons, and some of our own students who read yesterday, and then some others who've been reading this morning while we were sitting. And so I have been thinking about how to bring this to a close and sort of speak to poetry as it appears in Buddhism in the Zen tradition, and that's a very, very large subject. So I thought better to just go right to the heart of the matter. And this is a koan that I like very much. And the poem is one of my favorite poems of Master Hong Zhu, who was a Chinese master who is known to us now for having taught what's called the Silent Illumination School of Zen, or what Dogen brought back and spoke of as Shikantaza. And I couldn't find anything about his being a poet, being recognized for his skill and his depth of poetry. But his poems, which are, he created the Book of Serenity by compiling these 100 case koans, and then he wrote the verses. Another master wrote the commentaries and the pointer. And these poems, I believe, are the most excellent of all of the poetry that is used as capping verses in the koan collections. Blue Cliff Record, Gateless Gate, Transmission of Light, both for their beauty as well as for their depth of teaching. And so I thought I would let Hong Zhu, in a sense, have the last word. And poetry in Zen, of course, has such a long history and really a kind of a glorious history. Poetry in China at the time that Chan was developing was a very highly developed art form, largely practiced among the upper classes, the intelligentsia. It was very sophisticated. There was a lot of, structure around it. And, you know, what did people do before television and the internet? Many good things, actually. So poetry was a form of social gathering, a form of entertainment, if you will, a form of contesting or challenging one another's skill. I mean, it was has quite a history. And then as it found its way into the Zen tradition as a teaching, all of the things that are used in Buddhist practice, the Buddha images and mandalas and visualizations, koans, poems, paintings, they all have an aesthetic quality because that's an important part of who we are, relating to aesthetic beauty and fineness is an important part of who we are and how we express ourselves. But all of it is always based in practice. And so its aesthetic quality is important, but its real purpose is to practice. And so the purpose of these verses is not just to write a poem for the sake of an aesthetic expression, but to change our mind. And in a sense, that is the tradition of poetry, right? It's not just to paint a portrait that we appreciate on some aesthetic level, but actually to change the way we see things, to change our mind. And so last night, one of the poets spoke about poets as truth tellers. You know, and sometimes the truth that needs to be told are difficult truths. And so too in the Dharma. And so words are understood in Buddhism deeply, particularly in the Zen tradition, as having great power. The Buddha said words create karma. That is, they actually do affect change. They have impact, all kinds of impact. And we have all kinds of words. We have words that give instruction, words that convey information, words that describe, words that name, words that narrate. The Buddha said that there are words that are just deceptive, are not true, and that's their impact. We have words that are divisive. That's their purpose. We have words that are used like weapons, harsh speech. And we have words that are numbing. I can think of this often today, where really all of these four forms of uncompassionate speech are so prevalent. But numbing words, words whose purpose is to, in a sense, lull us into the idea that we're going to live forever, or that sort of encourage a state of apathy or paralysis. And then in the Zen tradition, we speak of live words, words that are to not only enliven or inspire, to rouse bodhicitta, but also to reveal the hidden, to clarify what's cloudy, to illuminate what's dark. And so we can think of this in terms of the pointer when he says, move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep, don't move, and sprouts begin to appear. And so really he's presenting this bondage of duality or dualism, of seeing the worlds in terms of two, things that stand in opposition, that stand against, to contradict, that oppose. And I was thinking of this morning because dualism, we think of isms often in terms of religion, Buddhism, and other forms of, things that we attach to that have philosophies, ways of seeing the world, and when we attach to them, they become isms, they have the potential to become blinding. And dualism should be right up there with the great religion of all human experience, all human nature, right? Putting into a place of reverence and sort of unexamined worship, we might say, the idea that that is the way the world works, right? So it makes sense then to have rich and poor. It makes sense that there are those who are privileged and underprivileged. It has sense that we would go to war. It makes sense that we are right and they are wrong, right? And the Buddha said, this is a, the ultimate blindness, the great delusion. And so he says we have to cast off both sides and also let the middle go, and then put on our sandals and travel some more. Because this goes so deep within us, it's so hard to see. And even seeing it isn't enough. Even realizing that it's not true, that it's false, that it's empty, is not enough. And so we have to continually buy more sandals and keep traveling. That's why training is long. And so when Dongshan says it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, this is the end of a training period, right? The end of the summer training period, which is typically the ango, the intensive training period. So he's bidding farewell to many of the students, the monastics who have come just for that training period and are getting ready to head out, go back to their home temples, continue the wandering, go to another place of practice. And so we can also think of this as just the end of this festival. Some of you will go east, some of you go west. Go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. Grass is used to often speak about delusion. So he's saying, go where there's no conflict, where there's no delusion, there's no suffering, there's no false sense of self, there's no self-clinging. For 10,000 miles. But of course, the question is, where is that place? Where is that place that's free of hindrance? When we hear this from an ordinary mind, an examined mind, we can understand this to mean, go to a place that's pure, right? Where there's no temptation, there's no bad stuff happening. There are no bad people around. Well, what about all of that within you and me? What are we to do with that? Where is that place? Is there such a place? The footnote to this says, luring cats into a well. Right? When cats go into the well, they don't come out. Right? So what he's really saying is luring people to their death. He's inviting them to lose their lives. And so here he's using words that are testing, that are probing, that are provoking, that are startling. So they've been in training for 3 months, intensive training, experiencing Dongshan's teaching. He could leave them. He could just offer them a bowl of rice and tea and say, good luck, travel well. Hope to see you again. In other words, let them leave feeling good, right? He wants them to feel good, but he really wants them to feel good. And so he says, oh, by the way, go to a place free of grass. As soon as the thought arises, this is grass, this is not grass. So Dongshan also says, where there is not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? How could you travel at such a time? So the moment we think, I am deluded, I am enlightened, I am suffering, I want to be free of suffering. Those words can have truth, and they also, in that very moment, grow the grass. And so in the poem, he says, the grass boundless. Inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. Grass is boundless. The footnote says, below, no bottom. Sides, no borders. So is he saying the grass is everywhere, there's no way to escape it? Or is he saying the grass is everywhere, there's no way to escape it? So we think that words have meaning, and that their meaning is in their meaning. But mind is understood in Buddhism as one of our sense organs. And when mind, a sense organ, meets an object, a thought, a line of poetry, a statement by a teacher, it's mind consciousness that gives it life. That's how it is that we can hear the same thing and hear something different, right? Which can be the source of our conflict, or a symptom of it, but it can also be the wonder of language. And so in Buddhism, and particularly in Zen, with the koans and the poems and all of these teachings, which are intentionally using language in non-ordinary ways and in ordinary ways at the very same time. And then the question is, what do you hear? And how does what you hear serve you? There's language that defines, there's language that explodes. There are words that offer answers, there are words that ask questions. There's speech that gives you something to carry with you as you go away. There's speech that acts like a thief. There's speech that increases our burden, and there's speech that opens us up to boundlessness. And so in koan training, when students work with koans, before working with koans, we work with the practicing the breath. We're doing other forms of practice, which are specifically, partly, because Zazen is many things, functioning on many levels, we speak of developing samadhi, shamatha, calming the mind, bringing the mind to tranquility. But an important part of what that means is that we're letting go of our thoughts and our concepts and our ideas. And we're also beginning to free up or expand or wean ourselves, in a sense, away from our deep, deep, unexamined faith in our thinking mind as a kind of absolute master or the source of absolute truths. Because it's that faith in our thinking mind, in our concepts, which makes them so difficult to let go of. And of course, that faith is all interwoven with our sense of who we are, our identity, and so on. And so in the years of practice, which really never ends, we're freeing ourselves of those thoughts and concepts. And so then, and developing a trust in the non-thinking mind. And develop trust in the non-thinking mind means to develop trust in the world as having a world or worlds beyond thought. Experiences, universes, realms in which thought cannot go with you, nor can they take you there. So when we're really trapped in our thoughts, our world, by in a sense, definition, the definition of those concepts becomes very, very small, very confining, and intensely uncomfortable. And so we need to really see the limit, both the power of the thinking mind, and have respect for that, because we also need to utilize that, but also see the limitations. And so then when we introduce the koan and begin holding these words, go to the place where there's no grass. In the mind, how does the student do that without bringing in concepts? So in the beginning, there is a concept. The concept is that phrase, that teaching. But they need to have developed the practice so that they can hold that phrase without becoming conceptual, without thinking. So it's not a reflection on the koan. It's not contemplating the koan. It's something altogether more unified. In our distracted thinking, it's like the words lead, the thoughts appear, they're the master, and we dutifully follow. Right? In mindfulness, when we're developing mindfulness, it's like the mind leads. And the words then have the capacity to come more and more into alignment. Rather than being the master, they're serving our awareness. They're serving reality rather than defining reality. And that's why these masters are using language in non-ordinary ways to startle us, to shake us free, to help us to come closer. Below, no bottom, sides, no barriers. So Dongshan says, where there's no grass for 10,000 miles, how can you go? When there is no idea, no concept. No eyes, no eye consciousness, no mind, no object of thought or emotion, no thinking consciousness. when we're not adding anything or taking anything away, then how do you go? When you've lost your legs and your life. In the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha speaks about this. He says, he's asked the question, what are words and what is meaning? And the Buddha says, speech depends on discrimination and habit energy as the cause. Habit energy is a way of speaking about our karmic energy, the energy that brings forth patterns of thoughts and emotion and reactivity and so on. He says there is the conjunction, the coming together, and the distinction between sounds and letters. I mean, speech is like, it's like magic, right? I mean, we take it so for granted, but it's like a miracle, right? We just make sounds. And then over time, those sounds came to convey meaning. They meant something, right? But they're just sounds. And then we went a step further, our ancestors, and started to, well, how could I convey this to you if I'm not there? Right? And so then language, written language, began to form as a way of preserving or transporting language. But they're just lines. You know, it's like in geometry, if you have a point and a line, you can create the whole universe. Well, that's pretty much it in language. You've got a line and you've got a period. Right? And with that line, you can make any shape you want. And with that, you can create every language that exists. Written language. So it's magic. Right? And it's all constructed. It's completely constructed. And so he talks about the conjunction distinctions of sounds and letters, which issuing from the teeth and the jaws and the palate, tongue, lips, cavity of the mouth, makes mutual conversations possible. Hallelujah. Oh my goodness. This is speech. And then he says, now, what is meaning? He says, the bodhisattva is said to have understood meaning well. When all alone, you go to a lonely place and you walk the path that leads to liberation. And by means of your transcendental wisdom, your prajna, which grows and strengthens and becomes realized through your hearing the Dharma, reflecting on it, and meditating, and then bringing that to a revolution. First at the source of your habit energy, that goes back to the source of that habit energy, the root. And by your wisdom, you now abide within the stages of self-realization that leads to a life full of excellent deeds. And so how do we understand the meaning of things? You go to a solitary place. You walk the path that leads to nirvana. We call it the Eightfold Path. And by means of your own inherent wisdom, your Buddha nature, you bring about a revolution that leads to a life full of excellent deeds. He says, if a person becomes attached to the meaning of words and holds fast to their agreement in regards to the original state, then they will come to cherish views, either affirmative or negative. As varieties of objects are seen in the samsaric world and are discriminated, statements will be erroneously made. We will speak falsely. Discriminations will erroneously go on and on and on. It is by delusion that discriminations thus go on. It is otherwise with those who are wise. And so when we attach to the meaning, we think the meaning is inherent. In a sense, what he's describing is our righteousness, how we become righteous. And the Buddha had quite a bit to say about righteousness, whether it's attaching to words of, you know, anything, ordinary, you know, understandings or Buddhism or the teachings. And at the conclusion, he says, as all things are empty, there is neither defilement, but nor is there purity. Things are not as they seem, but nor are they otherwise. And so the religion of dualism, of believing that things are absolutely this or are absolutely that, and which side do you stand on, is not a true reflection of reality. Therefore, it can never bring us peace. And so that's why the poem says, inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. Wherever you find yourself, wherever you find others, are they inside? Are they in our circle or are they outside? Ultimately, we have to see by ourselves, for ourselves, this very self. And then he says, to set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. I love that. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. Just get yourself born, right? That'll about do it. It starts about then. You won't have words for it yet, but they're coming. You will be amply supplied. Just show up. Open your eyes, see what's in front of you. Open your mind, see what's inside of you. Immediately, there's grass. And that's why Xu Shuang says, before you even go out the gate, or as soon as you go out the gate, he says, there's grass. So Dongshan says, when you go outside that gate, beware. Don't go where there's grass. Xu Shuang says, as soon as you go out the gate, there's grass. And Dayang says, actually, it's already here. Don't take a step. There's already grass. What is grass? What is delusion? The path to liberation, we think, is to get away from it. The path means to lead us away from suffering, to liberation. That makes sense to us, right? We like to travel from here to there. We know how to get from this place to that place. But this is a path that is made up of just one point. It has no line to travel. And so where we begin is where we end. That's why the Buddha said it's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, it's good in the end. He might have also meant something else, but that's true too. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. Every practitioner sees this. In fact, it's all too easy, isn't it? Why is it so easy? Why is it so difficult to let go of this forest of thorns? Why is it so difficult to find our way through it? As Shanti Deva said, I want to be free of my suffering, but over and over I see myself rushing back to the very causes of my suffering. Why this devotion? We are logical creatures. Everything we do makes sense to us. Everything every single person does in every moment makes sense to them. So when they are giving life, when they are taking life away, when they are loving you, when they are hating you, when I am loving, when I am hating, in my mind, it makes sense. And it seems right. Even if on a certain level I know it's not right, even if it's not how I want to be spending my life, in that moment, it makes sense. And that's why it's so difficult. That's why righteousness is so impenetrable. I remember listening to some activist, and they were who makes their whole life in trying to, you know, address the sufferings of the world. And somebody says, "What do you do when you're meeting somebody who just completely denies social justice or racial injustice or climate change or? How do you have a conversation with that person?" And he said, "You don't." You don't have a conversation. A conversation in that moment may very well not be possible. You can say words. They can say words. But you're not actually having a conversation. And so then for the Bodhisattva, the question becomes, how do you, when somebody when there's a door shut between you and another person, how do you reach them? How do you not give up when you have no invitation? It's a very important question to ask, to wrestle with, to experiment with, to set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. So beautiful. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. That when we set our cherished everything down, what remains is a luminous screen, radiance, clarity, non-obstruction, all things possessing self-nature, everything covering the ground upon which it stands, nothing in opposition. To harmonize the inner and outer, to embody the wisdom of, as all things are without self, there is neither defilement nor is there purity. This is the greatest challenge. To let go of thoughts, to free ourselves of strong negative emotions, to begin to transform our actions, our words, to begin to strengthen our intentions and our desires and bring them into alignment with reality. These things require dedicated practice, dedicated and sustained effort. But they're all very doable, right? In a sense, they're just a matter of course, right? Be encouraged, but don't, you know, ask for the day off. It's the matter of course. It's what should be happening. But to turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. To harmonize inner and outer. To manifest non-duality in a moment that seems intensely dualistic. As somebody asked an excellent question last night of the poets, the teachers, how do you, when you see something and the narrative in the mind or the narrative that's being presented is so intensely dualistic and seems so clearly so, how as Buddhist practitioners do we meet it? Do we proceed from an understanding, as the Buddha said, that things are not as they seem? That's not the fundamental reality, and nor are they otherwise. We can't ignore the facts. And so Hongzhi gives that language. He's saying this, and this is a long, long time ago. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look, look. How many kinds? I just finished reading a book called I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness. And she's an author, and she's also a Christian. And Christianity is a very important part of her life and her formation in this life and the work that she's doing, which is towards justice. And so she's talking about growing up as an African-American woman in a largely a white world made for whites, by whites, and whiteness. And she talks about, in this passage, she talks about love, which we can think of as love, and compassion. Because love is true and love is compassion, as Buddhism understands it. But love is such a word, right? Love has such meaning for us. And I wonder if in the beginning, that's why translators, as they brought Buddhism into the English language, so deferred towards using compassion, you know, so that we could really, which itself is laden with all kinds of meaning, but so that we could have some time to try and understand what does this actually mean, because if we call it love from the get-go, you know, it may be much harder. It is love. So she says, Christians talk a lot about love. It's one of our favorite words, especially when the subject is race. Words such as, if we could just learn to love one another, or love trumps hate, or love someone different from yourself today. And she says, but I have found this love to be largely inconsequential, not to have much power. more often than not, my experience has been, and here she's talking specifically about her experience of white folks, my experience has been that whiteness sees love as a prize that it's owed, rather than a moral obligation that it must demonstrate. Love for whiteness dissolves into a demand for grace, for niceness, for endless patience, to keep everyone feeling comfortable while hearts are being changed. In this way, so-called love can dodge any responsibility for action and wait for that great catalytic moment that finally spurs accountability. And I think this is so important, and not just in terms of racial justice or whiteness, but love and compassion in every direction. That compassion is another way of talking about moral obligation. And as Buddhists, we also have a lot of language for love and compassion. Every day we chant the Four Noble Vows, right? We can do, there are various practices, profound practices, important practices that we should be doing that are expressions of compassion, expressions of that love. The question is, in our mind, in that moment, who's included? And then after that moment, as we move forward, what are we doing about that? How is that being made manifest? What is our moral obligation? The Buddha realized in his enlightenment that that's our basic nature. When we talk about emptiness, about Buddha nature, that's another way of saying, right, the in a sense, the relative aspect of Buddha nature is that we are moral beings, which means that everything that we experience as either affirming life or destroying it. You know, there's the realm of neutrality, right? But where we're most concerned is in the realm of what's affirming and destroying life. And because that's what we do, right? Because good and evil doesn't exist outside of our consciousness. And because we're so busy about stuff, right? We're always doing stuff. We're producers, right? We're all construction workers, contractors, right? Building empires, small ones, big ones. And all of those actions are having a moral impact. And so what she's saying is that we can, in a sense, dissolve or become inert within a demand, within that moral obligation, that things remain steady, steady, right? Comfortable, be patient, right? So David Hinton yesterday talked about, because somebody brought up the question of this, and also within our Sangha, recognizing that we are so predominantly a non-diverse Sangha, white Sangha. And David appropriately and with truth talked about, you know, that we're practicing not just for this moment, but we're practicing for, you know, a year from now, 10 years ago, from now, 100 years from now, 500 years from now. And that over time, this revolution will take place. And I didn't speak at that moment, but I was thinking, yes, and we're not waiting. We cannot wait with endless patience. Patience is essential now, but patience isn't waiting. And while patience itself never becomes irrelevant, we will always need to be patient. When patience becomes waiting, it's not patience, it's something else. And so to look outside the luminous screen, how many kinds of injustice, how many pathways to meet them. And so Austin Brown says, I need a love that is troubled by injustice, that is perpetually uncomfortable with unjust injustice. And this is a very important part of practice. You know, we want to be at peace, and rightly so. And it's hard to appreciate how that peace can coexist within a state of being troubled by suffering at the same time. And that those not only coexist, but that they're not two. Things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise. She says, a love that has provoked anger when black folks, including our children, lie dead in the streets. A love that can no longer be concerned with tone because it is concerned with life, having the right tone. A love that has no tolerance for hate, no excuses for racist decisions, finds no contentment in the status quo. I need a love that is fierce in its resilience and sacrifice. I need a love that chooses justice. Amen. And it's easy to sit here and say that. Many of us, most of us perhaps, may nod in agreement and feel that that is true. And that is important, and it's also the easy part. What is it to turn the body outside the luminous screen? Buddhism, as I often say, doesn't tell us. It doesn't say, okay, now when you go home, do this. This is how to apply your energies. This is how to manage all of the important things in your life. I spoke last weekend about, you know, our 2,500-year glorious tradition of turning the light around, of stopping and seeing, of recognizing that the source of all suffering is my mind and your mind, of recognizing that a revolution is called for and that I don't have to leave home. And that what I'll discover in that revolution is my essential nature and your essential nature. But it doesn't tell us, and it provides a path. And we provide places where we can come and gather and do this most essential work. But it doesn't tell you when you wake up in the morning, okay, now do this. It doesn't say, okay, when this happens, respond thusly. Right? When the house is on fire, this is how you put it out. When insanity becomes sane, this is how you respond to that particular illness. It doesn't tell us those things. And doesn't that suck? No, actually. Right? For the same reason that a teacher doesn't tell a student how to respond, particularly Jukai students who receive the precepts, how to respond to their life. Because if the teacher did, and the teacher and the student responded appropriately, and it worked, what would the student have learned? Nothing. No empowerment. And if it didn't work, who's the student going to blame? Right? So no responsibility. And this is just the same thing writ large. And so, to see for yourself, see by yourself, is the only way. And so we're not given answers, right? And even in our work here, in the Dharma in Action work, in the Beyond Fear of Differences work, in the Earth Initiative, we come together and we're there not just to talk about stuff, we're there to affect change, right? But also to hold the facts, the realities, and the non-duality of all things. And to see all the world before us as not a problem to be fixed, something that is broken that needs to be repaired, a question that we will answer, but how to live into this. Ryokan said, since I came to this hermitage, he was a Zen priest and poet. Since I came to this hermitage, how many years have passed? If I'm tired, I stretch out my feet. If I feel fine, I go for a stroll in the mountains. The ridicule or praise of worldly people means nothing. Following my karma for this body I've received from my parents, I have only thanks. While he's expressing a very profound understanding about the nature of things, that can also be very easily misunderstood. Maybe when we receive ridicule from someone, we should listen. Maybe they're telling us something we don't know. Maybe they can help us to see something we can't see. And how do we receive praise? How? Right? To throw it back in somebody's face, oh, I'm practicing selflessness. I'm sorry. Right? Is to not receive the gift. But how do we receive? So all the praise that was lavished upon Hokyu, our postulant monk, right? Good job, good job, good job, right? How does he receive that praise? Well, only he knows. Some of us may find out. And that's living within a sangha. We do that for each other. For the while, going along with the old tree, with the same, the old tree is this one here. This old grandmother ash who's been here long before any of us and who's now passed from this life. And still she stands, and she will, in her glory, still beautiful, still presenting the truth, and also, it seems, providing pathways for other life. That's what happens to the dead. But the dead tree is also, in Zen, represents the Dharmakaya, the body that has no concerns, for whom ridicule and praise mean nothing. Right? The essence of selflessness, emptiness. So for the while, going along with the old tree, walking together, with the same emaciation, poor, destitute, no warmth, no adornments, spiritual poverty, carry nothing with you. In the cold, right? And about to follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. So for the while, along with the tree, in the winter, where nothing grows, with the same emaciation, spiritual poverty, having realized things are not as they seem. This self is not to be built up or destroyed. This life does not belong to me or to you. That all there is this moment and how we meet it and whether we affirm or destroy, whether we bring benefit or harm. That's our legacy in every moment. That's our offering. That's our purpose. That's our fulfillment and our despair. So from within that place, which you will never arrive at, follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. How gorgeous. And the footnotes to that says, just keep today's determination. Just keep today's right intention. Hold fast to your aspiration, and surely you will have a time of fulfillment. It's just a matter of course. That's what this path is. Tend to the matter at hand. Take care of today and don't restrict today in any way. And see all the ways in which we're not seeing today. See the self in all the ways in which we're not seeing the self. So I want to end with a poem. I thought it was appropriate. And, you know, I was listening to the poets last night who would sometimes sort of give you some important information before the poem so you understand it. I never do that. and I may never again, but today I will. And so when the student, particularly doing koan, or really when they're really turning towards examining and trying to clarify the nature of reality, goes into Doksan room, and they present or are tested in their understanding, and the teacher accepts that or does not accept that. Right? It's not yet clear. Go back to your cushion. See for yourself. Hold fast to that determination, and surely you will find fulfillment. And so the bell sends you back. In winter, I long for warmth. In summer, coolness. Is there any relief? Tracing back the root, there aren't so many things. Now, summer is hot. Winter is cold. Not even the bones can know this. Turning the cloud body, concerns are everywhere. Being caught or not caught is no longer approved by the dragon's bell. O traveler, you must see for yourself. Let the children's cries break you in half and reveal the depth of the cloud-draped moon one more time. I want to thank Margaret and Chase and Jane and David, who are all here to glory us with their poetry. It was such a delight to just be immersed in poetry over these 2 days. It was like bathing. It was so wonderful. And such an affirmation of both your respective voices, and particularly as practitioners and coming from, you know, a place of deep, deep wanting to know and wanting to affect change and wanting to express, and the careful craft of that, and also the wild spontaneity of that. It was just fabulous. And so there were calls to do this every year. No promises. Yeah, I know there are many of you who, so we'll look into that. But this was excellent, most excellent. And so I just want, on behalf of the Sangha, to really express our gratitude to all of you and to all of us who were here and made it happen and made it so wonderful. And that we keep both this very particular form of aliveness present in our lives, our poets, our poetry, and as a extension of that, or corollary perhaps of that, or perhaps the basis of that, our spiritual lives, our practice, our Dharma study. And so thank you, everybody.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.